In this next hour, we hear about one of our founding fathers and the country's first Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton, the man, the musical, and public policy. We invited renowned UW-Madison history professor John Kaminsky to tell us all he knows about Hamilton, the man, the musical, and public policy. Professor Kaminsky refers to Miranda in his talk, and he's referring to Lin-Manuel Miranda, the creator of the Broadway musical Hamilton. Kaminsky tells us where Miranda got it right and where he got it wrong about Alexander Hamilton, the man. The talk took place on May 17, 2018, at the Madison Central Library and was sponsored by the Madison Institute. But first we hear from Fred Wade, president of the Madison Institute, who introduces Professor John Kaminsky.
I'm very pleased to have with us tonight John Kaminsky, who is a renowned historian. He's the founder of and director of the Center for Study of the American Constitution, editor of the Documentary History of the American Constitution, which is now 29 out of 32 volumes that they've produced. It's a remarkable endeavor. And the author or editor or co-editor of more than 60 books, including one on Alexander Hamilton. And he will speak to us this evening on Hamilton, the man, the musical, and public policy. So with those introductory remarks, please help join me in welcoming John Kaminsky.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and I don't usually talk about public policy. People ask me questions, whether it be judges. I used to give seminars to federal judges all around the country, and they would always want me to respond to their cases, present-day cases. And I would always tell them the same thing. Anything after 1800, I consider as current events. And I'm not a journalist. I'm a Revolutionary War historian. And so I don't get involved in modern issues. And so this is sort of a break for me. And you'll see it's not too difficult for me to do that, because one part of my job is that I have to raise over $500,000 a year. And I raise that green money from red folks and blue folks. Doesn't make any difference. So I have to keep a nonpartisan point of view. And that's what I do. And so this will not be a partisan presentation by any means. But Hamilton is in vogue, and I've given a dozen presentations on Hamilton. Never once did I talk about public policy. So this will be a change in that direction. But what I hope to do is to look at two things: the 18th century and how Miranda doesn't do a very good job in the 18th century, and how he's ahead of the time in the 21st century when it comes to public policy. So those are the general areas that I'm going to be concerned with. First of all, I'd like to ask, how many of you have seen the play? Okay, maybe a third, maybe almost a half. Okay. I haven't seen the play myself. But because the play is not a typical Broadway play of a dozen songs, it is more like an opera. And it has, 40-some songs. And there are very, very few words that are in the play that are not sung. And those words are sort of transitional from one song to another song. And so the music is wonderful. And there are different kinds of music in it. There's jazz. What Did I Miss? A song that Jefferson sings when he comes back from France. What Did I Miss? Falls down to the ground and gives it a kiss. So happy to be back in America. There are some show tunes that are in there. The song Helpless. It's a wonderful, wonderful love song about how this young girl becomes infatuated with this dashing debonair Alexander Hamilton. There's a song about the death of their son, and how it's indescribable. The pain that they're experiencing. There's some tomfoolery in there about the king and about how haughty he is at first, and he appears that way with all of his regalness when he first appears. but the throne, the crown is tilted a little bit and almost falling off the third time he appears. He's on the stage maybe a total of about 14 minutes, and he's the hit of the show. And so it's his three songs are wonderfully comedic in the British attitude toward America. You'll be back, he says. Well, didn't happen that way. So there are a lot of things to speak in favor of the play, but it's a flawed play. It doesn't tell you the real Hamilton. One of the last songs is from his widow saying, "Who will tell his story?" I'd like to say, to think to a certain extent, I'll tell his story. And I'll tell it more fully than Miranda has told. Miranda tells you one side of Hamilton, the good side of Hamilton, not the bad side, and not even necessarily bad side. I mean, the bad side from the point of view of Jefferson and Madison, but also maybe from a certain moralistic point of view. The only bad thing about Hamilton in the play is he had this extramarital affair. According to the play, it's only one. According to John Adams, it's a multitude of them. So who knows for sure? But the song that he sings when he is seduced, and that's the way it is. It always is that way. You know, it's the men who get seduced by the women. If it were only, if we didn't have women in this world, the men would be able to run it so well. It's the women all the way from the very beginning with the apple. It's the women who caused the problem. Now, for 200 years, we had a genre of attempts to make peace with God, with those people convicted of capital crimes. And people won't forgive you, but God will forgive you if you're honest and you're truly repentant. And so they take down, at first it was orally, but then they wrote pamphlets and they sold, newspaper printers sold the pamphlets for a penny apiece. These people coming into town wanted to see a hanging, and this was great entertainment. And so they would sell the stories, and the story would always be the same way. The men would start, it all started with a lack of a respect for your parents. And then it was always a woman that got involved. Now, when the women were the ones who were being executed, it was always a man who led them down the wrong path. And so that's what Hamilton would like you to think in that song that he's singing, "Say No to It." He's beyond saying no. He's got the good side and the bad side. And the good side is saying, say no. But the bad side's, I just can't say no. I just can't say no. And you really see the anguish of him. And I tend to believe that that's true. And him having that affair, it's an unfortunate thing that he did, but he couldn't resist. And to Miranda's credit, he doesn't say it was a one-time affair. It happened repeatedly. But that sort of shows you the variety of that show. And it really is a wonderful production. But it is all one-sided. Now, what Miranda wants to do, I think, is a twofold thing in this play. And it's partly public policy, a wonderful time for his agenda. The agenda is, as Hamilton and Lafayette say, after the Battle of Yorktown has been won, we immigrants get the job done. And so immigrants are good for this country. Immigrants have made this country wonderful. And he wants to put that forth. I mean, he's the son of immigrant parents. And so this is an important thing to him. He also wants to show what a fantastic country this is that allows immigrants to pull themselves up and become leaders in our community, economically, politically as well. That this, you don't see this in many countries. So that's, I think, the main focus of Miranda in writing this play and the message that he wants to get across. Now, unfortunately, as I said, he doesn't know the full story. He draws upon Ron Chernow. Unfortunately, Ron Chernow doesn't know the full story either. I just saw a question and answer period on C-SPAN 3 this past weekend with Gordon Wood and Joe Ellis, two premier historians of the 18th century. And they talk about the issues I'm going to talk about. And one of the things they said is that the non-historians, the non-trained historians, have taken over communicating with the general public. People like David McCulloch and Ron Chernow and Walter Isaacson and Richard Brookhiser and a host of others. These people know how to write, and they know how to address the general public. Those are the kinds of historians, trained historians, that we used to have in America in the mid-19th century. We don't have those now. Now, trained historians write to each other, and they don't give a hoot about the general public. In fact, that's pandering. They want to talk to each other, and that's all. And so what we get, whereas Joe Ellis said, I've sold 2 million copies of my Founding Brothers, the typical monograph that a history professor might sell, maybe 100 copies, because that's all they're selling to, is to professors. And most of the time, they don't buy books anyway. They get the books out of the library, or they get free copies of the book. Here we have Miranda, who's not a trained historian by any means, and drawing upon Ron Chernow, who's not a trained historian. And in fact, what he wrote was biographies of financiers, the Rothschilds, and then in America, various other robber barons. And then finally he got to write, was going to write on Robert Morris, but then wrote on Alexander Hamilton. And it's a tough read. It's how many of you read Ron Chernow's book? Not too many. With these seminars that I gave to federal judges, they would always ask me about David McCulloch's book on John Adams, and then Ron Chernow's book on Alexander Hamilton. And many of them had read the John Adams biography, and they finished it. It's a thick, thick book. And then half of that number started to read Ron Chernow, and almost none of them finished. It's just too dense of a topic, and he didn't develop the love story as much as maybe McCulloch did. Maybe it's a matter of what you have to work with. Hamilton, you've got Elizabeth Schuyler that's there, but there's not much better love story than between John and Abigail Adams. And that's a wonderful, wonderful story. And so David McCulloch was able to really mine that and use that throughout. There's always that thread throughout the entire book. So the Chernow book is a tough book to read, but Miranda loved it, and it inspired him. So the judges, however, would say to me, you know, after I read the Adams biography and the Hamilton biography, I went away thinking how duplicitous Thomas Jefferson was. I never knew that before. And I said, you know, if you go and you read a biography of Jefferson written by a admirer of Jefferson, whether it be the six-volume author of the biography of Jefferson, or whether it be by Julian Boyd, the first editor of the Jefferson Papers, you read those biographies and you go away thinking, I never knew how duplicitous John Adams and Alexander Hamilton were.
You're listening to Hamilton, The Man, the Musical, and Public Policy, with UW Madison history professor John Kaminsky.
And so it depends upon who you're reading. And I have put on conferences for high school teachers, and they ask me the question, how can you be sure of what you're reading so that we can impart this correctly to our students? And there's no referee that tells you this is a good biography, this is a bad biography. And the only way that I know of is to read multiple biographies and to get different slants here. And so my slant of Hamilton is different than Miranda's because I look at him differently. I have a number of books that I wrote that were quotation books. I've edited it. One was called The Founders and the Founders. It deals with 30 people, 630 pages. All the people you know, Jefferson, Washington, Hamilton, Franklin, Abigail Adams, Martha Washington, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. My database, however, has 450 people. It's about 10,000 pages. And now I'm publishing a series of individual volumes, individual people. I did one on Hamilton first because of the play. I mean, I collected these 10 years ago, but one on Washington, and one any day will be coming out on Madison. And I've got another one ready to go on Jefferson and another one on John Adams. And so these are 300-page books, and they really show you who these people are, because they're descriptions of them by friends and by enemies and by themselves. And so you really get to know, if you get about 50 quotations, it gives you enough breath, so you get a pretty good analysis. If you have only one, you got to go by that. That's all you have, is that one quotation. These are what I've been mining for many years now, probably more like 12 years, collecting these quotations and getting to know these people pretty well. And I'd like to give a one-word description of different people. Now, Washington, what's the one word describing George Washington? Pretty easy. Duty. Duty is so important. What's the one word that describes John Adams more than any other word? Again, pretty easy. Vanity. With Hamilton, what's the one word? Again, I think it's pretty easy. Intrigue. And there's nothing in the Miranda play about intrigue. Yet that is the most characteristic trait of Alexander Hamilton, is his intriguing. Doesn't want to be president, just wants to make the president and control the president. He could be president, even though he's not maybe a natural-born citizen. You don't have to be a natural-born citizen to be president of the United States. Back at that time, if you were a citizen of the United States, that was good enough at the time the Constitution was adopted. Nobody was alive now that when the Constitution was adopted, so now it is a natural-born citizen. That's a requirement. But Hamilton was an intriguer, and that you don't get out of the play. So it's unfortunate. So the primary thing that I like to look at in the play, there's a lot of little errors here and there that don't amount to a whole lot necessarily. But the thing that I like to look at from a public policy point of view is Hamilton's economic plan. And Charlie Rose interviewed Ron Chernow a couple times. And after the second interview, he said, you know, all we need to teach Hamilton's economic plan is Miranda's play and your book, and that's it. We know everything. Well, I'm afraid that was not a correct analysis at all. Very superficial. And you come away with a totally incorrect point of view to fully understand what Hamilton wanted to do. Now, what did he want to do? He wanted to have a fairly broad interpretation of the Constitution. James Madison said there are three interpretations of the Constitution. One is a strict interpretation, which he didn't like. Second was what he called a natural or liberal interpretation of the Constitution, which is what he liked. The third one he didn't like was, the second one that he didn't like, was a forced construction. And that's what he says Hamilton wants to do, is a forced construction of the Constitution. To bend the Constitution to the will of Hamilton in the kind of country he wants to create, not being limited by this written Constitution, which is what written constitutions are supposed to do, to limit the practitioners here in the government. And so what Hamilton would have liked to have done is to create a government that is a benefactor of the wealthy, of the corporate community. He never considers any kind of social welfare program. Not too many people did at the time. Someone like Thomas Paine did, however. If you look at his agrarian justice, who wants a pseudo social security system. Anybody who retires gets a certain amount of money, $500 or so. Anybody who turns a certain age, like 18 or 21, to be an adult, you get a certain amount of money to help you get started in life. If you're sick and infirmed, you turn a certain age, you get a pension. If you're blind, you get $500 a year that will help you out. And so this doesn't go very far. So there are very few people who want that kind of social agrarian justice like Thomas Paine does. Hamilton certainly doesn't. But what he wants to do is to help the wealthy. And trickle down is it was not a, a phrase that was understood at the time, but certainly is what Hamilton wanted, was to assist the wealthy, and in the process, the country would benefit. Now, what Miranda says, quite simply, what Hamilton wanted to do was to establish a sound economy, make America sound and not bankrupt. That's what he felt Hamilton's plan was going to do. Well, to a certain extent, that's true. But no matter what happened, America was bound to be sound and healthy financially because of European wars. It didn't even make any difference if there was no new constitution. We could have been under the old constitution, the Articles of Confederation, and the American economy would have been very successful in the mid-1790s because the Europeans needed our agricultural goods, and that would have greatly benefited our country. It just so happened that the constitution did help in certain other areas as well, but the country would have benefited even without the Constitution. There were certain limitations on the states. They could not issue paper money. They could not make anything but gold and silver, legal tender. They could not impugn contracts. All these things are giving tremendous power to the federal government to restrict the states, which was a real important aspect for many people at that time. The people are sort of divided between those who want a national government and those who want state governments to be dominant, but just give some more, a few more powers to the federal government. Not a lot, but a few more that they needed, and we'd have a happy federal system. Hamilton was one of those handful of about a dozen, maybe 10 Americans who could be labeled nationalists, who in essence staged a coup d'etat, and they were terrific politicians, and they created this new government. A friend of mine, a Harvard law professor, I helped him with his book. It's about a 700-page book, and it's called The American Coup, which is how Americans drafted a undemocratic constitution and how they adopted it. And Hamilton is partly responsible for this. He doesn't want a democratic government. Democratic government is a dangerous thing, particularly if you're looking at it from the point of view of purely theoretical. Democracies are dangerous. And so you got to put some brakes on a democratic government. Hamilton wanted a lot of brakes on the democratic government. Hamilton wanted to get rid of the states if possible, only keep them there as far as they could be usefully used to create the programs of the federal government. And so he creates the bank. The bank is a very, very controversial issue. There were no banks at the time to speak up, only really two banks in the United States, the Bank of North America in Philadelphia and the Bank of New York that Hamilton helped establish. And the Democratic forces in Pennsylvania withdrew the charter for the Bank of North America, whereupon its money that it issued, its stock, went down in value, and the currency that it issued around the country it circulated, it went down in value. And so the next year, annual elections, there's a big debate, should they recharter the Bank of North America? And Gordon Wood, I mentioned him earlier, is this renowned revolutionary era historian. In one of his books, he said the most important single speech ever in American history was given in the Pennsylvania Assembly. It's hard to overestimate the value of this speech. And it's a phrase he used over and over again in his Pulitzer Prize winning book. It's hard to overestimate the importance of this. This is going to determine where capital flowed. Will capital flow to farmers, as it had in the past when individual money men loaned money, or will it flow from the banks to corporate interests and merchants and not to farmers? This is the most important speech in American history. Well, the book was reviewed by Edmund Morgan, who's since passed away. He was one of the deans in American history from Yale. And he said, he mentioned this story in this account, and he said, I think Professor Wood has, in fact, done what he said could not be done. He has overestimated the importance of that speech. It wasn't that important, but it was an important issue. It is determining where capital is going to flow. And Hamilton wants it to flow to the corporate interests, not to agriculture. And so we're going to diverge away. We're going to ally ourselves with Great Britain. Even though we've got a treaty, two treaties with the French, we're going to abandon them. This is public policy here. This is what he wants to do. And the French Revolution is coming on, and he hates the French Revolution. Jefferson and Madison don't. They see that this is the hope of Republican form of government. And if it fails in France, perhaps it'll fail all in Europe. It won't succeed. And maybe we will lose out in America. Maybe we'll be forced to go back to that halfway measure that is the British system of government with a monarchy. And so the French Revolution is very important for Jeffersonians, and it's anathema to men like Alexander Hamilton.
You're listening to Hamilton, the Man, the Musical, and Public Policy, with UW-Madison history professor John Kaminsky.
These are real public policy questions here. Who is going to be favored? Are we going to create an economy that in which speculation flourishes? And that's what happens. We have the Panic of 1793, led by William Dorr, Hamilton's assistant treasurer. He was forced to fire him because he's such a crook. William Dorr was. He was an Englishman. Talk about the first Ponzi scheme in American history. He brought down many other individuals that were gullible that invested with him. And the economy was a disaster in 1793 because of the policies that Hamilton was pursuing, speculation. And others saw this and didn't want this kind of government, this kind of economic danger, sort of Damocles over their heads. And so Miranda knows virtually nothing about that. And one of the critical things, he does talk about the dinner party in which the room where it happened, that's the name of the song. And Burr sings it because he wants to be in the room where it happened. One of the bad things about the play, Burr is made out to be sort of a nice guy. He wasn't a nice guy. He was sort of duplicitous in many respects. But he wanted, he was very envious of Hamilton and envious of Jefferson. And he wanted to be in the room where it happened, where the deal was consummated between Hamilton getting Southern votes for his assumption plan, assuming the debts of the state governments, the federal government would assume those debts, in exchange for moving the federal capital to the banks of the Potomac. Now, Hamilton comes across saying, wow, I really did it. This is a great thing. And in fact, Washington says in the play, not true, if you don't get this done, I'm going to be forced to fire you. Not true at all. The fact that the federal capital is moved to a slave state has major ramifications. The fact that there's slave auction block right there in view of the federal capital, the Capitol building, and legislation is passed to protect slavery. I mean, that is a critical issue that is never brought out, even though Hamilton is an abolitionist of sorts. Never really does anything to get rid of slavery. And at the end of the play, Eliza says, what wouldn't he have done had he lived? Well, he lived for 50 years and did nothing to help get rid of slavery. Would he have done anything more in the last 20 years if he had lived that much longer? But he did get the capital moved from New York City temporarily to Philadelphia for 10 years and then permanently on the banks of the Potomac, where it is right now. And that did have major political consequences at the time. So there are a number of other issues, but I think I made my point here that Miranda doesn't know much about the public policy ramifications of Hamilton's economic plan. His very simplistic point of view. Now let's get on a good side of Miranda, because I do really like the play. I understand plays are any kind of artistic, a book or a play or a movie has its limitations, and you've got to accept the fact some are worse than others. A lot of what Miranda does is remarkably accurate. It's just he doesn't do enough. I mean, there are things that he doesn't talk about. The errors of omission are more important than the few errors of commission. The errors of commission are relatively insignificant, but it's the errors of omission that are significant. So what does he do well in our 21st century? We are living in a time period, it's coincided with my adult life, where we see early American history being denigrated and being forced out of the academy and forced out of high schools. Most of the time now, if you want to take a course in American history in high school or in college, you start with the 20th century. You do not have American colonial history. You do not have the American Revolution. You do not have the Constitution. You do not have the Civil War. Maybe you'll have Reconstruction. More often than not, you'll start in the 20th century. That is what the public policy decision has been. And exactly how does that happen? And it's partly a matter of the universities themselves and the professors in what they know and what their high school teachers. I wanted to be a high school teacher when I was growing up. That was my aim. We don't teach it anymore. And there are several reasons we don't. One is what I mentioned before. History professors don't talk to the public. They talk to each other. And the reason they do that is partly because history has become no longer part of the humanities. It's a social science. And we use the modern technology in social sciences, particularly computers. We use roll call analysis. The narrative is despised, is ridiculed. We got to get more involved in this than the narrative. We can't tell the narrative. That's too simplistic. We got to get involved in psychohistory or computer analysis of folks. That's the important factor. And to get tenure, you got to come up with a revisionist point of view. We had a Jewish professor on campus probably 20, 25 years ago. I won't mention his name, but he was in labor history. And so he had a joint appointment in the history department and in the economics department. And his book was published he had gone to Yale, I believe it was, and his book was being published by Oxford. And his analysis was there is no clear corollary between this economic action and the labor movement. Well, this was just heretical. First of all, the Jews were heavily involved in this, and they were the staunch advocates for the labor movement, and you had to have that. Well, he was denied tenure. Nobody before him was denied tenure that had written a book. He wrote the book that didn't appeal to the folks that were in the history department and the economics department, and so they denied him tenure. He was forced to leave. Didn't write the right thing. The right thing was to be activist in writing the history. That was part of politics. I used to be in the humanities building, the most inhumane building on campus. That's all it was called for a long time. Now it's called the George Mossy Building, which is sort of interesting because I don't know if any of you know George Mossy, but he was involved in the planning of that building, as was my major professor, Merrill Jensen. And there were no female bathrooms for faculty members in that building because we had no female faculty members and never would. It was their attitude. Well, now we have more than majority that are women, and many of them are politically quite liberal. And it was very difficult to hire anybody because they wanted similar folks to be hired, politically the same point of view. Ironically, the folks who hired them were more conservative elements, all men naturally, but they opened it up to others. But they were the new group that came in were not so tolerant. they wanted similar folks. And so we have a revisionist point of view that is on campus, and it's sort of fueled by Howard Zinn. Any of you know Howard Zinn, the historian? He was a great historian, great writer, but he was also a revisionist, and he virtually every chapter in his book ended the same way. This wonderful American story didn't really tell you what you really needed to know. You needed to know a whole race of people were downtrodden, blacks. Another race of people, genocide, the Indians, and a whole gender, women were not given their rights. Every single chapter ended the same way, showing the disgraceful nature of the American story. And so that gets part of the academy then, and that's what teachers are learning. And then, not surprising, they won't teach the traditional story of American history. And so it's that revisionist side. And when you come to revisionism, it doesn't make any difference that you're totally off base. We have a Wisconsin PhD history that wrote of a revisionist biography of Aaron Burr. It's just terrible. I mean, it's unbelievable. One reviewer said, anytime you look at a document, every time she looked at a document about Aaron Burr that could be viewed either positively or negatively, she always viewed it positively. I don't want to name the name. Aaron Burr, the name of the biography is about him. But any time that this biographer took a document and could be viewed either way, she always viewed it positively. Anytime she took a document that could only be viewed negatively, she always viewed it positively. And so you throw out reality and you come up with a new story, and it doesn't make any difference that you get attacked left and right by folks. It's just that your name is being mentioned and you're going to get tenure because of this, because you're creating waves. And so that's an unfortunate thing, and that has sort of driven the public policy on, should we stay in the 18th century in American history? Should we teach this? Now, we had our own little peculiar bent here at the UW. I came here to work in my PhD in 1967. And it was an important year for this campus. We had lots of riots going on, the Dow Chemical riots. When I was a TA out of Bascom Hall, right next door, the Commerce Buildings where these riots took place with the tear gas and that. So I was right there in the midst of them. I wouldn't say that I was an activist by any means in the Vietnam War riots. I went to them and saw what was going on as a spectator, but I wasn't an active member. But we know who the members were, who the activists were. And the university tried to eliminate that. And you know how they eliminated it? The graduate students from New Jersey, New York, Illinois, Ohio, and Texas, they were the ringleaders of the TAA, the radical element there that tried to have these riots. So we can't come out against them directly, but let's eliminate history and composition as required subjects. We'll eliminate the jobs. And that's what they did in the 60s. And to this day, history is not a required subject in general education. Neither is composition. Even though so many students don't know how to write, still there's no English composition requirement. We have a writing lab that helps students. But this was a political decision that was made in the late 60s at how to stop the rioting going on campus. Get rid of these outside agitators from their giving them financial support as teaching assistants. You eliminate their jobs. And that hasn't changed. Now, you go to other campuses in the UW system, and they do have requirements, history requirement and composition requirement, but not on this particular campus. That hasn't changed. So that Vietnam War experience drove the public policy here of not forcing history to be a required subject. And so when you're training folks in the School of Education, which is a great school of education on this campus, a lot of them, these are people that are going to become elementary school and high school teachers, but mainly elementary school teachers, because they don't have a particular specialty, they know virtually no history because they haven't taken history courses. One of the reasons why a lot of students don't like history courses is because they are forced to write, and they're fearful of writing in these history courses. It is a bit of an irony that politicians, and often it's Republican politicians, and it's not, I'm not saying this because I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican, but I remember often seeing President Reagan finishing his talks and talking about how wonderful American history was and how we ought to be driven by the principles of the founding. And in the next breath, behind closed doors, what can I do to cut out federal funding for history programs? So many times the history programs were zero budgeted by Republican administrations. And the struggle, I've get federal grants, two federal grants, for 40 years of my running the center, almost 50 years. And it's been a real struggle. But it's because the Republican administrations have, their OMBs have zeroed out the funding for support of history. And the reason it survives is because the history programs are so cheap. The funding of the history programs that we have, the NEH, the National Historical Publications and Records Commission, different museum programs, like one airplane is what it costs. I mean, the NHPRC that funds us, one of our primary funders, they get $4 million a year. I think it's now up to $6 million. It had been $4 million in 1964, and it stayed at that level for about 30 years, $4 million to fund the entire documentary editing program that Edmund Morgan, that I mentioned before, he said the single most important scholarly achievement of the 20th century was the editing of the documentary editions of not only the founding fathers, but other historical figures. To give us, I mean, talk about democratizing history, that we have made it possible for someone to sit in their homes, in their offices, and to do the history that no one could have done before, because we have searched over 1,000 libraries. And we brought everything together, and there it is, not only in the books, the 30 volumes that we're talking about, but is now available on a subscription at Rotunda, University of Virginia Press, and for free at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Digital Library. So if you want to know that what we've done for 40 years creating this documentary record, you can go online. Anybody can go online, and it's free. Talk about democratizing the writing of history. And that's what's available. And that's what these federal agencies have done. But there has been a concerted effort to kill them. The present administration certainly has done the same thing. But Congress, through its wisdom, has said no to these overtures and has preserved these programs. Because they are partly such a pittance that it's very easy for the administration, whether it be Reagan or whether it be Trump or whether it be Bush, either Bush, it doesn't make any difference. It's not worth the effort to fight against them. The savings is so little for them for this, and they do such wonderful work. Now, one of the things that's so important, and I'm going to end on this, there are other agencies that have stepped to the fore, and some of them are very conservative, like the Jack Miller Group, that teaches early American history. And they have centers all over the country. They approached me, would I like to have a center here at the UW-Madison? Well, I was too old for that. I don't want to do that. I have my own center that I created. I'm nonpartisan, and so they're very partisan. The Center for Civic Education, which is nonpartisan in California, advocates early American education, civics education. Sandra Day O'Connor has a group, iCivics. So these outside groups are concerned about teacher education and history education. You see this all the time in reports, how little Americans know about their own history, how little they know about how government works. They can't pass, a typical American can't pass a test that an immigrant must pass to become a naturalized citizen. But using this idea, we've got to get early American history back in the classroom, which is something that a lot of people really want to do, and they're trying to find some way of doing it. Whether it be from the right or the left, doesn't make much difference, just to get it back in the classroom. So this is a problem, and I must say that Miranda has done just a miraculous job to invigorate young people. If you go to the website and look at Hamilton and see what has happened in high school students, the teachers are being forced to teach it because the students want it, and they're putting on productions themselves. And Miranda is going out of his way to support these students to come to New York and to Chicago and other places, giving $10 a seat tickets for them to get there. And so he has been just simply marvelous in stimulating early American history in the classroom and among our young people today. And that's something I can never praise him enough for. David McCulloch did the same thing in writing John Adams. And a lot of errors in that book, but I get on the plane and I would see people reading the biography of John Adams. What a wonderful thing that they were interested in that.
And now a discussion with the audience.
We only have the one mic, so I will repeat your question so we get it on the tape. Well, the question was, years ago, it was always difficult to get up to the Civil War and maybe beyond it a little ways because so much time was spent in early American history. But this is a phenomenon of about starting 40 years ago or so and gaining steam as it goes along. And so now I asked a colleague of mine, one of my deputy directors, who taught for 30 years in high school, and he said that this is partly driven by school boards, and which have a political agenda, but also an economic agenda, that the teachers can't teach it. Therefore, they'd have to hire specialists, and they don't want to do that. Often, you know, the joke used to be the coaches would teach history. Well, now nobody teaches history. Not the coaches. No one teaches history. Another question. Yes. Well, Gore Vidal is, again, one of these great writers, and let's not let facts get in the way. The question is about Gore Vidal and his biography of Aaron Burr. And one of the things that he did was the question about the duel. Why would there be a duel? That Hamilton said something negative about Burr, and that this is a very dangerous man, and he did something terrible. Now, what was it that he did? And Burr wanted him to apologize and take back this general statement. So what Gore Vidal said was Hamilton understood that there was an incestuous relationship between Burr and his daughter. Now, there's no evidence for that. There is a very close relationship between Burr and his daughter. I like to think any of you men out there have daughters. And when your daughter was 4 years old to maybe 10 years old, you were Apollo. You could do nothing wrong. But when they got to be about 12 or 13, you could do nothing right. Burr's daughter never got to that stage. She always loved her father. And he had a mutual respect for her as well. In fact, he said the reason he wanted to conquer Mexico was not for himself to be king or emperor of Mexico, but to make her empress of Mexico. And so years after the Gore Vidal book was published, he admitted, I didn't have any evidence for that, but I put it in because I knew it would sell books. So he sort of pandered to what would sell his books, and he was a great writer. Any other questions? Yes. Yeah, so the question was, are there historians out there who write well and are neutral enough that will present a well-balanced point of view? And I think there are some that are out there, and some are better than others. But Jack Rakoff, for instance, who teaches at Stanford, nearing retirement, he always wrote with the documents right there. And not that he copied the documents, although I like to copy documents because they wrote so well. I have a series of chapbooks, short biographies, in which I draw heavily upon the documents and vignettes. They're wonderful, wonderful stories. And it brings them to life, trying to understand them. But Rakoff will have the documents right in front of him and use those documents to make sure that he's accurate in what he's saying. And that's an important factor. I was asked once, as an editor, how do I become a biographer? And one of the things I said was, you got to take off your editor hat, where you're restricted by the documents, and you are faithful to the documents, and be a little bit looser in your interpretations, because you don't have everything spelled out. I mean, there's a lot of interpretation that's there. And so it's a different kind of writing when you're writing a biography compared to a documentary edition. So there are folks. Now, Gordon Wood and Joe Ellis were on. Gordon Wood is a pretty good historian, I would say. He's written some wonderful things. Sometimes what happens as you get a little bit older, you're a little bit freer in what you're saying. You maybe forget some things, and so you're not as accurate as you used to be. But there are others. Joe Ellis has written some very popular books. A lot of times he's secondary. That is, he's not doing the primary research. And Joe has had a problem with the truth in his books and in his personal life. Years ago, he said that he taught at Mount Holyoke, and he said he wanted to teach a course on Vietnam. He said, I went to Vietnam, and I was an aide to General Westmoreland and helped him a great deal. Then I came back to the United States, and I got the peace bug, and I worked with the peace movement and helped to get us out of the war. Now, he never left the United States. It's total lies. None of that was true. And the Boston Globe exposed him, whereupon the president of Mount Holyoke attacked the Boston Globe. Even though Mount Holyoke had this honor system, their students were expelled if they broke the code. Well, finally, he was suspended for a year. He's a great writer. And there are historians and pseudo-historians, non-trained historians, that do write well, and some of them are faithful to the documents more than others. But there are a number of them that do that very well. Richard Brookhiser, not a trained historian, but I think he writes very well. Yes. William Appleton, Williams was a revisionist historian, is what the question was, and why? Why was he known that? He was in diplomatic history. And so he was looking at the documents and trying to get around what motivated the Americans, not the typical kind of foreign policy history that was being written at the time. He was looking at the alternative side of it. And had his own thesis that the politically left element had its agenda in diplomatic history. Now, he left here just as I was coming here because it was too much work for him with graduate students. He had so many graduate students that he went to, what was it, Oregon State? Yes. And so he had that political agenda personally that translated to his historical writing. And so if you pick up a Williams book, you understand the interpretation you're going to get from it. Yes, back there. Yes. It was about 30 years ago, we had a conference here, the Historical Society, that I helped with arrange on the Civil War. And one person asked a question of a very prominent Civil War historian from Virginia Tech. What do you think about Ken Burns' Civil War? And his response was, the more you know about the Civil War, the less you like Ken Burns' Civil War. And so that's true of a lot of things, that historians who know a lot find fault very easily. When I go in a restaurant and I see a menu, could be a terrific menu, what I see is the typographical errors that are in the menu. that stands out to my mind. And so we have our biases. But Oliver Stone, a good example. I get Turner Classic Movies, and they have a production with Oliver Stone. And he talks about how anytime you do a documentary on something, he did on the JFK's assassination, you're bringing in new evidence, and you're drifting away from history. Yeah, that's true. And sometimes you really drift miles and miles away, as Stone does. And he defends himself. He thinks this is a good thing. But if you see his movie on the assassination of Kennedy, I mean, it bears absolutely no resemblance to reality. And he has no conscience that was done. And so I think that there are these documentary editions by Ken Burns. I personally think they're wonderful. Baseball, I'm a great baseball fan. I think he went overboard with a race in baseball. He did Jackie Robinson. That's fine to do Jackie Robinson because you're aiming at that. But his baseball series was probably 50% race. And race is an important issue in baseball, but not 50%. To the exclusion of other things, especially if you're a Midwesterner and he's pushing the East Coast teams and not the Cubs. And I'm from Chicago. So there are problems. My good friend and colleague, Rich Leffer, he asked me a question about Miranda and how could I like it so much when I know it's filled with errors? And I turned on him and I said, Rich, you know very well that you hate docudramas because you know that they're all in error, except for one, The Six Lives of Henry VIII. He says, this is what he told me, I'm not going to read anything on that because that docudrama on TV, that's my history, and I don't want to find out that was wrong. So that's my history. Unfortunately, many of these kinds of productions, they stray from the truth, and that's what becomes history. I mean, that's The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, right? The movie, do you know the movie? At the end of the movie, Jimmy Stewart, the senator from the territory, the state, and he tries to confess that it wasn't me who shot this terrible person, Liberty Valance, it was the John Wayne character. And the newspaper men say, no. When the history butts up against the legend, print the legend. And so that's what's important. And so that's often what happens, that these docudramas, whether they be by Ken Burns or whatever, and Ken Burns does this very, very well, they become the history. So there's a real responsibility on their part to get it right. Unfortunately, many of them don't get it right. I think Burns does a pretty credible job. Yes? Okay, so this is a critique of Burns and his Vietnam War story. I must admit, I didn't watch it because I figured there'd be a great deal of that, and I lived through it. In fact, many of my students would come and they say, you were here on campus when these riots were taking place, and so I had firsthand experience, to be sure. And it's tough to watch those things that you experience and you know it's not exactly as you remember it. Now, maybe our memory is not so great all the time either, but these are problems that exist in writing history and in these kinds of productions. Another question. So much of my time, I can't keep up with everything in my own period. And so I've been thinning out my library at home. And my wife wants me to do that. And my shelves are now, I don't see too many books that are in the shelf because the books are coming up in front of them. And so I've decided I'm going to get rid of books that are not of real use to me in my time period. And so there's quite a few books there. And so it's very hard for me to keep up in my own field. If also I want to write Merrill Johnson, who was my major professor, he only wrote about 5 or 6 books, and he had tremendous knowledge. And when he died, I worked with him for 10 years after I got my PhD, and I realized what a loss that was to scholarship, the knowledge he had in his head. And I said to myself, you know, I feel a certain responsibility that I should get the knowledge that I have out for other folks. And so that means writing. And so I spend a lot of time writing. I am a very hard worker. I will be working till usually midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, and then I get up at 5 every morning. So that's my schedule, unless the Brewers are playing at night, and I usually watch them. So what's that? I would say most Wisconsin historians are known as anti-federalists, and I'm sympathetic to the anti-federalist plight. One more question, okay? It was not a pleasant experience to live through that and to see the National Guard on campus. I must say I left Madison for 7 months in February of 1970, came back in September, which is a wonderful time to be off campus. The bombing of Sterling Hall took place then. We had a terribly acrimonious TA strike at the time, and also the movement for Afro-American department, Afro-American studies program took place then. I was finishing up my minor field in the summer of 69, taking a course with William Young. I don't know if some of you knew William Young in political science, and he was teaching a course on the presidency, and we were invaded by about 15 young, strapping black men, and they wanted to talk about democracy and about this Afro-American program. And so Young said to us, okay, we'll put it to a vote, democracy. How many of you want to talk about this democratic issue? None of us raised our hands. How many of you want me to continue with my lecture? We all raise our hands. Whereupon they literally picked him up and carried him out of the classroom. And so that was kind of the world we were living in at the time. It was a dangerous world. And you saw the good side of many politicians and professors, and you saw the bad side. You saw how they might encourage students, but when it got down to a crunch, how they abandoned the students and left them to their own. And so I have some pretty bad memories of the time. I mean, not anywhere near bad of the physical violence that took place and the war itself. But with my decrepit condition that I'm in, I probably won't be attending. Okay. Well, thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Hamilton, the Man, the Musical, and Public Policy, with renowned UW-Madison history professor John Kaminsky. The talk took place on May 17, 2018, at the Madison Central Library and was sponsored by the Madison Institute. For more thought-provoking programs by the Madison Institute, go to their website at themadisoninstitute.org.